When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, Beaver Nation, and welcome to Beaver Banter, an Oregonian sports podcast. I'm Joe Freeman, senior writer with The Oregonian, and he's Nick Daschle, Beaver's beat writer, The Oregonian, and we're here to talk all things Oregon State, as usual. Nick, how you doing? Sorry, listeners, we were unable to do it last week. I had to go to Pro Day on Monday. Nick was doing spring practice the rest of the week. I had baseball, so on and so forth. So we're chock full of stuff today, as long as my voice makes it through. How you doing, Nick?
Good. I was going to say we have a new sponsor. We're sponsored by a gravel pit, and Joe has eaten an entire bag of gravel today.
So I thought you were going to say some kind of cough drop.
Voice is a little rough.
Yeah, that's all right. It's part of life, you know.
They don't pay us for our voice. They pay us for the pretty faces, and no, mm-hmm. they pay us for that. We'd be out of that too.
No, speak for yourself.
Yeah, well, I know. That's what I said. I just said, well, that's what I'm saying.
All right. Well, we've got a lot to get to today, so we'll just get right into it, Nick. First up, a few news and notes. The women's basketball team landed a number 3 seed at the Albany Regional and will open the NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament Friday against 14 seed Eastern Washington. If the Beavers win, they would play the winner of Nebraska and Texas A&M in the second round. Both games will be at Gill Coliseum, and it's the fifth time in school history the Beavers are hosting NCAA tournament games. So quite a turnaround there. We'll get more into that, of course, later in the pod. Also, the football team wrapped up its second week of spring practice last week at Reser Stadium. The Beavers are going to take the next 2 weeks off for finals and for spring break before resuming workouts on April 4th. As for men's hoops, well, the Beavers bowed out quickly at the Pac-12 tournament, falling to UCLA in the Pac-12 tournament opener. They lost 10 of their final 12 games of the season and finished 13-9 overall. But the big news, of course, came from Nick last week. Scott Barnes, OSU athletic director, confirmed that basketball coach Wayne Tinkle will return next season. No surprise there, but the confirmation you never know until you know.
That's right.
One more news item before we get knee deep here. This one's on the baseball team. The Beavers climbed to number 2 in the D1 baseball top 25 this week after another winning weekend. They took 2 of 3 games from Utah in their first Pac-12 series of the season. The Beavers had a 12-game winning streak snap on Sunday when they squandered a 9-run lead. I don't know how you do that, but they managed to do it. So the winning streak's over, but they did take 2 of 3 from Utah, and they enter the week a sparkling 20-2 overall. Wait, that's not right. 20-2. What am I talking about? I think there's 18-2. I'll look that up. Let's get into women's basketball. How do I not know that off the top of my head? It's either 17-2 or 18-2. I don't know, Nick. Does it matter?
I do not know. I know they've lost 2, Arkansas and whatever that beer league softball game was yesterday.
Yeah, no, they're 17-2. It came to me. They're 17-2. Yeah. They were trying to go 18-1. It would have been the sixth time in school history they had done that, which is pretty remarkable, actually.
Yeah.
Okay, well, obviously the biggest news right now with Oregon State sports is women's basketball. Beavers, like I said, will open the NCAA tournament against Eastern Washington. Eastern Washington finished the season 23-5. They won the Big Sky Championship. Teams have met 11 times over the years, with OSU winning 8 of those 11 meetings. I don't know where to begin. We got a lot to unpack and digest here. I guess just generally speaking, looking at the 4-team field in Corvallis, the Beavers regional draw, kind of what are your thoughts? What did you, what were your impressions when you first saw how things unfolded there, Nick?
Well, I was down in Corvallis yesterday for the big, you know, whatever you want to call that, reveal with the fans. And I suppose it was a little anticlimactic, even though, you know, it's still great to find out you're in the tournament field officially. But everybody kind of knew Oregon State was going to be a 3 seed. Mm-hmm. It would have been a surprise in any other direction, a 2 or a 4. So they kind of knew it. And it was really down to, do they play Portland or do they play Eastern Washington? Because that seemed like the two most likely teams that could be a 14 seed and slotted against. And it turned out to be Eastern Washington, which, you know, I mean, Eastern Washington has done, they've had some games this year where you could make a case that Oregon State better be on their game Friday. They took Gonzaga to the wire in December. They were leading Cal by 13 in the fourth quarter and lost that game. They played a number of NCAA tournament teams this year, so they're tested and they've got a lot of seniors and juniors on their roster. They've got a sixth-year point guard who's got a bunch of stats, and she's a two-time All-Big Sky Defensive Player of the Year. So, I mean, they're a 14 seed. It's a game Oregon State should win, but it's not a game that you could just put in pin on your bracket and move on. They'll need to show up and play. The overall thoughts on the bracket, though, with Oregon State – yeah, you know, obviously South Carolina sits up there like just in neon lights. That's the one team you don't want to see at the top of your bracket. Mm-hmm. But there's a reasonable path to get to South Carolina, and it's not like South Carolina they're undefeated. But I wouldn't say that they have been, you know, like a couple of the other South Carolina teams that just look dominant and darn near unbeatable. I mean, they've had some scrapes. I mean, they really should have lost in the SEC semifinals to Tennessee. It was just a lucky bank shot at the in overtime to beat Tennessee. That was a game they probably should have lost. And they've had some other close games. So I wouldn't say Oregon State it's impossible they could win this regional, but there's a good path to it because, you know, Nebraska has beaten Iowa. That would be their second game if Nebraska goes to form and beats Texas A&M. But Nebraska's also got 10 losses, and they rely a lot on three-pointers. Oregon State's pretty good at defending three-pointers. So it looks like there's a pretty good chance Oregon State's going to get out of Corvallis and get on to Albany. Yeehaw. Albany, New York.
When you look at that second round match against Nebraska, I think is intriguing because, like you said, they do shoot a lot of threes. And if they do get hot, well, that makes things pretty interesting there. And then, obviously, they also have Notre Dame in their bracket, which they would, if they make it out, most likely would have to face. They're the 2 seed in their regional. And then, you know, going back to South Carolina, weaknesses aside, they are the, you know, money favorite in the tournament, the number one overall seed, the best Vegas odds to win the tournament. So, like you said,
Notre Dame is not, you know, they're the 2 seed, but they've lost some players. It's my understanding they've lost a few players here recently, and they may have some trouble down low guarding Reagan Beers based on one of the injuries they've got. So, you know, that's a week off, and Oregon State's got to win a couple of games. But it's not an impossible path to at least the Elite Eight. To get past South Carolina, well, you know, let's see. But to get to the Elite Eight, it's not impossible.
Yeah, and you brought up just getting to the Elite Eight and what that would, you know, that's quite an accomplishment. And no matter what happens moving forward, when you look at this season, you know, and we've talked about this a little bit, coming off last year and the last 2 seasons overall, it's been quite a dramatic turnaround. And that was one of the things that struck me from Selection Sunday and the things that Scott Ruick had said You know, kind of, and you wrote about this, just looking at the, I don't know, the secret to their success, but just their evolution over the last three seasons from the dregs of the last 2 years to now. You know, he kind of talked a lot about continuity, and, you know, which kind of fuels chemistry and generally speaking, growth within the system. You know, looking back at exit interviews last year, those I imagine are very stressful for coaches, especially in the new transfer portal era where, you know, women and men can leave at their will whenever they want. And so after two losing seasons, to sit down in your exit interviews and have every single player say they're going to return, for a coach like Ruick, who has a pretty, you know, detailed and complicated system that requires time as much as anything and, you know, repetition, I know that was music to his ears, but I guess just could you speak more to what he had to say and just, you know, when you look at the evolution over the last 3 years, how far this team has come?
Well, you know, with Scott's program over the years, and this isn't just Scott specific, it's, you know, it's a case with a lot of, you know, good coaches. They build their programs to where they lead, where the juniors and seniors are leading the way because they've been in the system for a few years. And while at the same time, they're grooming the younger players to become those juniors and seniors down the road. Well, that worked for quite a while until the transfer portal era hit. And Oregon State kind of avoided some of that for a while. Actually, women's basketball did for a while, but it hit pretty hard in 21. That's when, I mean, you saw Oregon and Oregon State both get hit hard with transfers. And, you know, I don't know that Scott was surprised, but I don't know that he quite knew how to navigate that period, that new era of I'm losing these players. How do I make this roster work? And it took a couple of years and get the right players, and they bought into what they're doing at Oregon State, and they all decided to stick around. And I mean, frankly, they don't lose anybody off this roster. And if they all decide to stick around next year, I mean, you could make a case that they might be preseason 1, 2, 3 next year, going into next year, because everybody's back. And I mean, they'll have the ultimate Scott Ruick team, a lot of veterans and they won't have to lean on any freshmen even. So, but that's been, and I asked him, I said, did you have any doubt? You know, did you have any doubts? And he was pretty honest. He said, yeah, there was a lot of doubt you know, because he didn't know how the offseason was even going to go last year until he talked to the players. He mm-hmm. just had no idea. And he seemed grateful that they decided to stick around and want to see this thing through. And I mean, they were paid off this year with a 24-7 record. And I mean, six of their seven losses are to teams that are one or two seeds in the NCAA tournament. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and they were in every one of those games. You know, if Reagan Beers was available in a couple of them, I think they probably would have picked off a few more of those. So, yeah, it's all about keeping the players around that system and learning his defense. That takes some time to figure it out. It's not like he expects you to know it right away, but you know, the longer you're there, the more things you know about it and the better you are. And it's showing up statistically. I mean, they're one of the best defensive teams in the country this year.
Yeah. Big picture, looking at the transformation, the thing that strikes me the most, and I think it has been one of the critical components to Scott's success over the years and what he has built in Corvallis is just that culture. And you hear coaches and players talk about that. And as a journalist, you kind of, you know, you don't roll your eyes, but you hear it from everybody. And culture is one of those things that you can't really describe, but you know when you're in it, if you're in a good culture or a bad culture.
Right.
And being able to get everybody back being able to keep everyone on the roster and have them grow, I think speaks to that culture. And, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, I kind of, when both teams were humming, Oregon and Oregon State, I remember going to the schools to write about that rivalry, which had kind of taken epic proportions that season, you know, drawing insane crowds and both teams, you know, in the top 10 or wherever it was, top five maybe then, I don't remember. But one thing that always struck me on the Oregon State side of things was, you know, the idea of family and how that's kind of the culture that Scott tries to instill there. And, you know, they talked about how often they would just walk into Scott's house and have dinner or hang out at his house, and the things they did behind the scenes. You know, the players would regularly babysit Scott's kids. And as a current parent with 8 and 5 year olds, I wish I had a team of babysitters on the ready. But I don't know. It's one of those things where you can't measure culture and chemistry, you know, with a statistic, but it does get you through tough moments in games, I believe, and through tough moments in a season when you do have that. And long term, it makes people want to stick around through the good times and even the bad. And so I don't know. There's something to be said about that.
Well, when you have good culture, you can have leaders that can get in people's faces, hold them accountable, and they won't take it personally. Whereas, you know, I've seen some bad culture at Oregon State over the years. I mean, mm-hmm. men's basketball a few years back, that was, I mean, again, it's not, you can't really describe it, but you know it when you see it. And you could see it was pretty bad 2 years ago with the group they had on that team, which yeah. is why most of them aren't there anymore.
Right.
You know, in football, you've seen it with you know, the Gary Anderson crew. Mm-hmm. You know, they just never really came together at all. And, you know, that was probably more on the coaches than the players, but yeah, and it just you could tell these women like each other, and they like being around each other. They have fun. You could just tell from watching the bench what, you know, how it's going. So, yeah, the culture thing is, yeah, again, like you say, it's not something you can really describe. You just know it when you see it.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, success fosters that too. But looking at the draw, being at Gill Coliseum is immensely important for them, obviously, for those first two rounds. And so that's going to be a huge, you know, feather in their cap or whatever, you know, advantage for them. I guess beyond, you know, kind of springing it on you, but can you identify what might separate them or what has separated them throughout the season when they're playing their best? Like what kind of needs to come together for them over the next, you know, few weeks to make a run here?
Well, their best games have come when their defense is really, really on point and they can get the transition, when they can get into transition and score, you know, off, you know, a pass or two and get, you saw that against, say, the Utah and Colorado games, the one at Colorado and the one at Utah, the way they got the ball up the floor after making quick stops, and that was there. The passing on this team has stepped up dramatically from a year ago. That's another thing that's kind of separated this team from say the last two, is the passing is just a lot better on offense, and they're getting better shots, and they've got more players that can hit threes. And when you got somebody like Reagan Beers in the middle, you know, she demands the double team, and it opens up the shots for the 3-point shooters. And so, yeah, it's just been a combination of things, but really it still goes back to defense with this team. If when they're playing, when his teams are playing great defense, they're usually a pretty good.
We got anything else that we want to talk about, or should we move along to football?
Oh no, I don't. I think we're good. We're good on that. There's going to be, you know, we can address next week what happened. So yeah, no, there's nothing. Nothing that I can think of off the top of my head.
Well, we'll get into spring football here in just a minute. We probably should briefly discuss Pro Day last week. 13 draft-eligible OSU players participated in Oregon State's Pro Day. There was an enormous horde of scouts there, almost 50 NFL scouts, coaches, and front office personnel were in Corvallis representing 28 different teams. I thought it was most interesting. The Chicago Bears had 5 people there, their head coach, their offensive coordinator, their offensive line coach, the Patriots, Steelers, 49ers, the Jets, so on and so on were there. I believe, you know, obviously the biggest draw is Fuaga, who is a near lock to be a first round pick. But you kind of hear a lot of buzz about the Jets looking at him. And obviously with that Chicago Bears contingent there, you know, a lot of attention from them as well. But, you know, Anthony Gould was pretty, you know, fared pretty well there. Oladapo had a really good day. Ryan Cooper Jr. Those are kind of the Beavers' big, you know, draft hopefuls, I would say. They're 4 most likely to be drafted. And, you know, I kind of wrote about that last week. We don't need to go knee deep in Pro Day. But for more information, you know, just visit.
Those four are going to be in somebody's camp, whether they're drafted or right. You know, get a free agent deal. They'll be in somebody's camp. And I, you know, I'm trying to remember who some of the other ones were. They'll be last year. I think I want to say there was 8 or 9 Beavers that got some sort of a deal, whether they were drafted or got a free agent. I would think this group is probably somewhere in that neighborhood as well.
One thing that was interesting, I guess, is worth noting of the guys who aren't among those top four was Isaac Hodges. Worked a lot at fullback, ran a lot of patterns out of the backfield. Tristan Chebbia was the only guy they had there throwing balls. So it was kind of funny. He, you know, I imagine he's been throwing balls during spring practice here and there, but he's a grad assistant for the football team now. He's back on campus. And, it was kind of funny to see him kind of get thrown out there. But, Hodgins worked at fullback almost exclusively, as best as I could tell. I didn't see him do any line drills. So, perhaps he sees that.
No, his future is, if he's going to play in the NFL, it's going to be as a fullback or H-back or something. He's too small to play on the defensive line. But I mean, you know, the bloodlines are there with his dad playing the position and his, you know, his brother's in the NFL. So,
He had some nice hands. He really caught some good passes. And I thought he fared well from what I could see. Yeah. I mean, I don't know how much stock goes into these pro days. My time covering the NBA, a lot of these things are almost more notable for the interviews that they do. And, you know, every player I had talked to was rushing off to do some kind of interview with a team, and they had several stacked up, or they had visits to different cities to meet with different teams. And a lot of times those interviews and the face-to-face goes as far as, I mean, there's, you know, thousands of hours of film on these guys. So if you're going to draft somebody, you're going to do your homework there. A lot of it's the getting to know them as a person. As far as spring football goes, I think Nick and I are kind of in agreement here. It's very difficult to size up anything or make any grand declarations about this team after six. Is it six spring practices so far?
Yeah, it's been 6.
And these guys they're not wearing pads. They're not hitting. It's, you know, basic stuff. And especially for this team with so many new faces and you know, virtual and almost an entire new coaching staff, there's just a lot of teaching and a lot of learning and a lot of that kind of stuff going on. Generally speaking, from what I saw at the ones I attended, the defense absolutely, you know, dominated the majority of the practice. There were some offensive highlights here and there for sure, but with so many new, especially on that side of the ball, well, shoot, both sides of the ball have so many new faces. But you know, with a new quarterback and a new system and all that stuff, it's really hard to, I don't know. It's hard for me to take much away from this beyond these guys are in the nitty gritty and the weeds, and they're trying to learn a new system. And I think we'll see a lot different, much more advanced team come fall. But right now, I think this is going to be the norm over the next, you know, when we get back to spring come April.
Well, the second week of practice, which I covered the whole second week, and that was more that was more advanced than what you saw, because they were in pads all 3 days.
Oh, really?
And they also Saturday was pretty much a scrimmage. It was what you might see in the spring game, kind of, not entirely, but they definitely. They didn't do much in way of any fundamental drills. It was, you know, put the ball down and situations and things like that. And yeah, you're right. The defense is absolutely owned the first six practices of the spring, but that they should. I mean, Oregon State's offense is undergoing a transformation. They've got a bunch of linemen standing on the sideline with crutches. They're breaking in new quarterbacks. Damian Martinez obviously is a constant, and some of the running backs are, you know, they pretty much know it, but the receivers are, it's a new group there. They're a little light on tight ends. They're trying to work in this new system that they're going with. And the defense is just owned them, and that really, that's what you want. You want your defense to look good, you know, in spring and for most of the fall, because, you know, they should know what's going on. If the defense doesn't look good during the spring and the August camps,
it's a red flag.
Coaches have told me that's not good, because I mean, they should know what's going on and they should know what's coming. And these guys do, they've caused a lot of turnover possibilities. They haven't got to all of them, but they've caused fumbles. They've got their hands on interceptions and recorded a few, you know, they're making plays on defense. I don't want to say I'm impressed, cause it's spring practice. It's only six practices, but yeah, the defense so far has looked like something that you'll want to keep your eye on come September. It's just too early to say about the offense. I don't really know. You know, we haven't seen Jabari Johnson. Trent Bray has said, you know, he's hopeful that he'll get some work in the second part of the spring, but he's not certain. So right now it's Giovanni McCoy and Ben Gulbranson going at it, and Gulbranson's looked pretty good. I mean, again, it's early, but I would say he's got a leg up at this point. But
I would agree with that based on what I've seen with McCoy and Gulbranson. I would say Ben has a leg up as well. I was a little surprised at. McCoy is not a big kid. He's pretty skinny. He's not, you know, super tall. He definitely is an athletic kid, and he throws a very accurate ball. But I imagine his head is spinning right now, because, you know, he's got Idaho in his back pocket, and I imagine played under that same system, you know, for 3 years there. Well, now he's coming into a whole new system with a whole new set of guys at a whole new level of competition. And so I guess it's natural. And I always go back to last year at this time. DJ Uiagalelei did not look great, what I saw at spring. And I would say he was behind Ben as well at that point. So, a lot can happen. Certainly between now and the season opener, in the fall, but this is what this time is for, I guess, is what I'm getting. It's what you want. And that's the whole point of it. As far as the defense, I mean, there's not a new system the defense is learning. So, all the returners, you know, they know what they're doing. And all of the new guys, it's kind of easier to learn defensive schemes, basic stuff in spring camp for sure, than it is an entire new offensive system. And I imagine there's install going on every day all over the place, but especially on offense, it's probably been, I would guess it's more of a snail's pace on offense and a lot quicker install on defense.
Yeah, what you want to come out of the spring with is the offense kind of knowing what they want to do, and then they spend May, June, and July, you know, doing individual drills and workouts, trying to polish it, and then by like the second or third week of August, you want to see that they know what they're doing. I mean, I think it's the best you can hope for right now. Given, you know, you don't have Joshua Gray out there, and you know the linemen. There's two or three guys that they thought, you know, were going to be starting offensive linemen aren't even out there right now. Won't be all spring. I mean, so as long as they're making progress and learning, I think that's the best you can. That's what you want out of the spring with the offense. The defense is just needs to. I mean, there's still a lot of positions open on defense, but you can certainly see the talent. It was notable to me that last week that Skylar Thomas was out there in the 7-on-7s and even some 11-on-11s. If he's back and fully healthy, that's a huge boost to their secondary, because he would have been one of their better players on defense last year before he tore up his ACL. If he's back and he's ready to go, that's a boost for Oregon State.
I think their secondary is going to be pretty good. They've got some guys returning there, obviously Jaden Robinson and guys who are coming up.
They got Singleton from yeah. Liberty, and there's reason to be hopeful there. And the defensive line even looked good. The defensive line had a lot of good moments during Saturday's scrimmage. So, lot to like there on defense.
Was there anything that stood out when Bray spoke at the final spring practice? Did he offer any insight that was worth revealing?
Well, as you well know, not going to get a lot of insight out of Trent Bray unless you just probe and probe and probe. But I'm hopeful as spring goes on and we get into August, he'll be a little more forthcoming on stuff. But I guess, it's just going to be more. We'll probably get more information, you know, from the position, from the coordinators, I would think, you know. We'll see. But no, he didn't really say it. He didn't really have any, you know, anything to, you know. There's going to be a couple new players show up come spring. They'll enroll in school this spring. One of them is the 6'10" offensive lineman from Colorado, which that'll be interesting to see him. I'm trying to remember which side of the line he played on. Can't remember if it was left or right tackle, but one of the two. He's obviously going to be a tackle. You know, you can't be 6'10" and play guard or center. Well, I guess you could, but not typically where you have those guys play. But
not as old as you, Nick, but I had a senior moment last week. I was like, I remember covering Ryan Gunderson in high school. And so I looked it up in our archives, and sure enough, I covered his last high school football game at Central Catholic. Him and his Rams lost at Lake Oswego in the playoffs, and then kind of mentioned it to him at Pro Day that, hey, I looked this up. I covered, that's how old I am. And he was like, yep, I threw four interceptions. He remembered it.
Yeah, right. They remember that. I mean, Joey Arrington remembers the five picks vividly in the Oregon State game, and they remember that stuff.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. Okay. Well, do we have anything else there with spring football, or should we move on to the second rank baseball?
No, team? I'm hopeful that the spring game is actually a real game of, you know, at least something competitive. But they've got to have enough healthy bodies to do it. But Trent seems up for doing it if he can. Jonathan never seemed to want to ever have a game. He was always, you know, well, you don't really have enough bodies when they actually did. He just didn't want to get anybody hurt.
I get it. Yeah.
It was always a kind of a snoozer. So it'd be nice if he could, you know, it doesn't really matter who wins or loses. You just like to see, you know, something competitive, I guess. So we'll see. But the door's still open, sounds like, because Trent seems interested if he can do it.
Okay. Well, looking at baseball, the Beavers, you know, kind of just continued. They're sort of in cruise control here. They were tested against Utah like they hadn't been. They had one kind of notable comeback win against Cal State Northridge in one of those crazy games with multiple delays in Corvallis a couple weeks ago. But, you know, this was their first conference season, so sort of their first, you know, Pac-12 test. And it was probably a little hairier than many would have thought. They had they needed two comeback wins, or two late game rallies anyway, in the first two games to win. They had a 5-run ninth in game one to come back and win that one. I think that final was 7-5. And then they kind of entered the eighth in a 0-0 tie in game two, and you know, had a big eighth inning rally there. I think they scored seventh in the eighth inning there to win that one. And so, kind of interesting to see a team show a little, you know, late game chutzpah there and kind of flash a little comeback tendency, because as we all know with baseball, you're not going to win 12-2 every game. So kind of the only that was sort of a takeaway, you know, in that series. The only thing really holding them back right now, and nothing really is, because they're 17-2, but you know, injuries continue to kind of, if there is something slowing them, it's that. Aiden May missed another start. He did not pitch against Utah. Mitch Canham kind of said he's progressing well, and I think his quote was, he's pretty darn close. So that's about as revealing as Mitch has been over the last 3-4 weeks with Aiden. I kind of thought he would only miss a start or two, but they're really being extra cautious with him, which I guess makes sense. You know, their first conference game at Utah is kind of another colder weather city, so that probably contributed to it too. I would guess he would start this week, but we should know more, I suppose, you know, later in the week. Kyle Scott, their closer, still has not pitched since surprise, and he continues to recover. Brady Casper kind of re-aggravated his leg injury, you know, legging out I think it was an infield single or a ground out against Northridge. And he didn't play at all this last weekend. So he continues to really battle whatever he's going through. And then I haven't seen AJ Lattery pitch in 2 or 3 weeks. So he must be having something going on with him. He's one of the few guys I haven't asked about. I've asked about six guys or so, and he's one that I didn't check in. So I'll have to check in on him, but you know,
what about Caraway?
Caraway returned. He missed the last series. He was just sick. I think there was some kind of bug going through the team, kind of a stomach bug. And so, but yeah, he returned this series. He didn't play, I believe, in Sunday's finale. They started Jaben Trotsky at short and moved Hainline over to the third, which ended up being a good call, because I think Trotsky had 4 hits. So,
yeah.
But yeah, he's scuffling a little bit. He's started to strike out a lot more than he had shown, you know, over the first 3-4 weeks, but he still had, he still produced, you know, in the series despite that. So, you know, it's, they're what we thought, and maybe even more. I mean, I really went into the season with high expectations for this team with so many returners. You know, the one kind of, if there was a question mark, it was pitching. And I think the majority of that has been answered, assuming that Aiden May returns and stacks to the top of the rotation, just slides back in there, because they definitely need that Friday night guy to you know, stack their deck. Kamats has been pretty solid. Eric Segura finally had his kind of blow up inning against Utah on Sunday. He gave up 6 runs in the fourth, and that kind of contributed to them blowing a 9-run lead in that game. But I'll tell you who has been, you know, obviously you would say Travis Bezzana is the team's MVP, and you could list any number of offensive players, but reliever Bridger Holmes, for my money, has been the Beavers' MVP. He has just been ridiculous. And I kind of wrote about him after his second outing against Northridge. You know, he has just a ridiculous arm slot. He's a sidewinder, a submariner, and he hits 93, 94 with his fastball, you know, 92-94, and his slider is just, it looks like it's going to hit the batter. The first batter to face so many times, like, jumps out of the way thinking they're going to get hit. And then the ball crosses the plate for a strike. It's, you know, Dorman has described it as gross. Other guys have called it wicked, and, you know, and insert your adjective here, but he's 2-0 with 3 saves in, I believe, 7 appearances this season, has yet to allow an earned run, struck out 16 in 10 innings. And he's just been dominant. Now he'll hit a guy. He's hit 6 guys. One time he hit his first 2 guys and then ended up striking out the side in appearance. So that kind of shows you where that's at. But, you know, to have 3 saves when your closer is injured, and I almost wonder if he's taken over the closer job at this point, to be honest with you. But, you know, he pitched in 3 of the 4 games against Northridge and then closed the opener against Utah. So just an invaluable piece of that bullpen so far.
Well, I mean, at the college level, that's got to be a real weapon to have a guy like that, because, mm-hmm. I mean, the guys in the big leagues, they've seen sidewinders before, and they're pros, mm-hmm. but I mean, college guys, they just don't see those types much. And I mean, if you're only seeing them like once every now and then, you can't really get used to them. And so mm-hmm. it's not like he's going to be out there. I mean, if he was pitching like 7 innings or something, you could get a beat on him maybe, but yeah, that's got to be a real weapon for Oregon State.
And there was his second appearance. I think it was his second appearance against Northridge. He earned a save. It was his first career save. Maybe it was his first appearance against them. He threw 11 pitches and they were all sliders, and he struck out the side. So he's just, it's if it's on, it's a borderline unhittable pitch, especially, and he didn't have to in that game, but when you do pair it with that fastball, it's hard to do anything with it. His story is interesting. You know, he went to North Bend High School, didn't throw very hard, threw in the mid to, you know, 86, 88, somewhere in that range. I can't remember off the top of my head. And then went to community college. He threw overhand in high school, and then kind of started tinkering with his, he said, you know, I always had a nice sidearm delivery. I always threw it well. And he just kind of self-taught and kind of, you know, perfected that, and then got more heat on his fastball, including in fall ball here in Corvallis. He added a couple miles per hour on his fastball just in the time he's been here. And so when you can throw 94 with that slider and that arm slot, you can be a real weapon out of the pen. But he's just an interesting story, a guy who, you know, kind of came out of nowhere to become an integral piece here. It's so funny. Baseball is the one sport where you can hear a story like that every year. There's so many teams and so many players, and so many guys get overlooked or develop later, whatever. The next thing you know, they're just huge pieces important pieces on very good teams. So he's a good kid. It's nice to see him kind of develop.
Zayman, have you? I mean, since you've been covering Oregon State, have you seen anybody throw a knuckleball?
I haven't, that I've noticed for Oregon State. They haven't had any knuckleballers.
I just. It's hard for me to believe a college coach would recruit a knuckleballer, because it feels like if you're throwing knuckleballs in high school, I mean, that's kind of what guys do when they've pretty much given up.
Yeah, when it's over, when it's that or nothing. It's like Tim Wakefield, you know, he was an outfielder or whatever. Yeah,
he's kind of given up. And so, yeah, you probably don't see a knuckleballer in college, but I'm just curious if there'd even been one around.
No, they do have another side submarine pitcher, AJ Hutchinson, but he just doesn't throw as hard as Bridger does, and his slider isn't quite as – he's been solid. He has taken both of their losses this season, but he was really important last year as a freshman, and you know, he's – I imagine he'll get a little – he'll find his groove here. He's having a little bit of struggles here and there. But But I've generally been pleasantly – well, I don't know if that's the right word. I've been, you know – pleasantly surprised isn't the right word, but the bullpen's been pretty solid. There's a lot of arms out there. I think they're still trying to identify and establish roles, and that's been a little bit more difficult because of the injuries. Assuming AJ, you know, has had a little setback, and Aiden May's out. Kyle Scott, you know, who was supposed to be their closer, is out. You're juggling a lot of different roles, and pitch counts are limited this time of year. So, you know, it makes you throw more. But, you know, I think that they have enough arms, certainly when healthy. But if Aiden May comes back and slots the top of the rotation, eventually Kyle Scott will come back. They have enough arms to make a run. And like we've talked about their offense, we don't even really need to elaborate on that. It's pretty lethal.
Yeah. Now, as for the bummer part of this whole deal is the schedule. I mean, can you imagine if they just swapped last weekend for this weekend, had the Utah series in Corvallis? With the weather they had, students are going into finals week looking for something to, you know, blow off steam. Mm-hmm. I mean, the weather was in the mid-70s in Corvallis during the baseball games. At least that was what was showing up on my car when I was down there this weekend. And now this weekend, they're going to have Washington home, and it's, you know, 50-50 rain, mid to high 50s. I mean, it's not terrible as far as temperature, but I mean, there's probably going to be some, you know, some moisture in the air. God, if it had just been the other way around, that'd been perfect.
Yeah, it was picture perfect baseball weather.
Yeah.
But you know, Dashiell, it's like I tell my kids, you can't control the weather. There's nothing you can do about it.
Okay, Coach Freeman. You can only control what you can control. Yeah.
Well, do we have anything else? Should we end it on that?
that coaching tip. Yeah. Get your, if you're going down this weekend, get your parking spaces early, because Friday it'll be Washington Friday and Sunday is going to be basketball and baseball on campus. And I think there's something else too, if I remember right. No, maybe not. Maybe softball.
Wrestling?
No, it can't be wrestling. No, they're done, except for NCAAs. But no, softball might be home because they were on the road last weekend. So they're probably at home too. So at least Friday and Sunday, I know, is going to be, you know, pretty busy on campus. So
yeah, and Friday's game against baseball game against Washington starts at 5:35. So
yeah, and Oregon State women play at 5:00. So
get there.
Although I should backtrack on that. This is also the end of finals week, and so the students will be gone, and so it won't be bad. In fact, what is this week? What is this weekend? The 20? No, the softball team is even off this weekend, so they're not playing. So yeah, you'll be fine. Never mind what I said about the weather or about the park. You'll be fine.
Well, please stay up to date on all your Oregon State teams at OregonLive.com/Beavers. And we will be back next week, just ahead of spring break, when your boy is going to San Diego. We'll be back with another podcast next Monday. Does that work for you, Nick? You gonna be able to do next Monday?
Yeah, I don't. If I'm going to Albany, it wouldn't be until probably Wednesday or Tuesday or Wednesday, I guess. So yeah, I'll be. But that's the beauty of these podcasts. You can do them from a boat out in the ocean. So
yeah, well, I'm going to be near the ocean leaving Tuesday afternoon. So if we are either going to have to do it Monday or Tuesday morning.
You going to Petco Park?
I haven't decided yet. I think maybe it's opening weekend.
Have you been there?
I have not been inside. I've walked around. I heard it's incredible.
Yeah, well, my daughter went to University of San Diego, and so we went to a few games there. Yeah, it's pretty spectacular.
Yeah, the problem is my daughters and my wife could not care less about it. So it would be the experience, and I'm like, are they going to make it longer than the fourth or fifth inning? And how much are tickets on opening day? And so it's the reward risk reward situation there. You know what I mean? So,
there's no chance that your daughters and wife are less interested in baseball than mine. Mine would go strictly for the food, and then as Monica got into college, you know, where's the alcohol at and things like that. So,
well, she's got her priorities straight.
that's what baseball games are for my kids. And it's where's the Dippin' Dots? Where's the food? Where's the the beer or wine or whatever they're serving at the game? So
Well, the first 3 days we're going to be over on Coronado Island, and then the other 4 days we're going to be in a different spot. So I think we could probably just take the ferry over or whatever it is, the boat across, and just walk to Petco. So we might end up doing that. We'll have to see how everybody's feeling. All right. Well, we will hopefully bring you a podcast next Monday or Tuesday. And if not, we'll bring you one in 2 weeks when we're all back and we have even more to talk to. So thanks again for tuning in, and we will talk to you again soon. Take care.